Yes, for taping.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in this case, I'll talk to you and the microphone. I'm very glad to welcome you here in the meeting room of two institutes of the Center for Social Innovation and SORA. I'd like to explain to you, because we have some people who usually are not here in our premises, we cooperate. We have two institutes who rented rooms in this building about 2 years ago, and it proved to be very fruitful to have two social scientific institutes in one house, which led to much closer cooperation and less competition between us, and strengthened us compared to the outer world. So this is why we use this meeting place here downstairs and not upstairs, because this is a common room we have. Now, I also would like to welcome in particular Stephen Downs from Canada, and all of you whom I do not know. But I'm very happy that in this case we have a mixed auditorium for you. I'm not able to really introduce yourself. I think you should do it better on your own way. But I know that you have come for the Eden, for microlearning conference, and that you are the one who will give us a talk on the next generation or the new generation of e-learning, which is very much appropriate, and I'm happy that this also takes place in the general course of our so-called ZSE lectures, which we do not regularly, but in an increasing intensity and frequency since last year. We invite international guests or guests from Austria who do work with us in some regard, either by organizing conferences or in European Union funded projects, and this proved to be very fruitful for us to learn more about the work and to learn more about the people. So, Stephen Downs, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. This is kind of an odd microphone because it doesn't actually connect into a PA system. So, it's a very odd sort of feeling. It's like I'm talking into the ether. See, now he has earphones on. And you know, have no idea how tempting it is to yell. So with that, I'd like to wrap up and thank you very much. I love doing that to people. Unless you didn't even notice it. Okay. What do I want to do? I've got a bunch of things I wanted to show, because I said I'd do this. Now I get out of the way here. There's a poppy from Bratislava. This is a very informal presentation. Most of you probably haven't been to any talk that I've done before, except Norm, who's heard it all before, and Seb, who's heard it all before. I should say. And so I keep things. I'm actually going to stay seated. I'll feel a bit better seated for this particular room. Usually I stand and walk around, but it's kind of... this microphone is really weird. I like to keep things really relaxed, really informal. If you have any comments or anything like that you'd like to contribute, or questions you'd like to ask anytime during this talk, by all means, please interject your comment, except for Norm. Norm, I expect you to keep your radical thoughts to yourself.
Never!
We will have no anti-corporate tirades from Norm Friesen at this talk. So what else have we got here? Now, if you're wondering what I was doing in Bratislava, let's see, where is it? Here's me in the crypt. And I just want to show you one more. This is the spookiest picture I have ever taken. Isn't that spooky? I find it very spooky. And this is the close-up view of that. So pretty spooky. Anyhow, I thought you'd be interested to see my photos from Bratislava. That's why I came all the way from Canada to show you pictures from Slovakia. Okay, I'm just kidding. My work is in e-learning technology, learning technology, and I'm going to play with the sound levels and see if it bothers me. This talk is in three dimensions.
I think it's enough if you just lay down.
Is it? Okay, good. I'm just having too much fun with this microphone. Right. Vienna. I really should close, especially that Internet Explorer. I'll close that Internet Explorer and then, okay. Come on. Silly Microsoft stuff. Ta-da. All right, now we're actually beginning the talk here. Those of you who have been listening online, thank you for your patience. There really is a talk coming up. I like doing that too. I do work in e-learning, online learning, but my background is in philosophy, and so I come at this subject not from strictly a pedagogical point of view and not strictly from a technological point of view, but rather I bring in aspects of ways of knowing, ways of seeing, epistemology, philosophy of learning into my understanding of online learning. And it's that approach to things, and as well my view that accessibility is important in learning, that led me to online learning in the first place. It's that view of things that originally led me to design a learning management system back in the 1990s and to adopt and embrace an approach centered around learning objects, again, in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And some of you may have seen my paper on learning objects. More recently, I've been characterized, interestingly, as somebody who has argued against learning objects. And while I would argue against the specific way that learning objects have come to be developed and represented in the field, I still believe in that concept. And what I'll be talking about today is basically two parts, because I have so much time, and I really, really appreciate having the time. Usually I have to do something like really quickly, get in, get out, and wait for the IBM guy or something. So this time I do have time. Let me ask a question, though. This may seem like an odd question, but it's not. How many of you here smoke? Any? Okay, one? Okay, so I do need to have a smoke break for this. I quit smoking recently, but I'm still really sympathetic. And I know where your mind is going to be in about 45 minutes to an hour, and it won't be on the top.
The smoking
part. Anyhow, actually, I'll play it a bit by ear, and if someone wants to moderate the time, but because it is a longish session, if people want a short one cigarette break in the middle, I have no problem with that, and I'd be perfectly happy with that. Two basic things I want to talk about. One is the ways of seeing through the internet and how that leads us to a network-centric approach to online resources and online learning. And then following from that, the more practical applications of that. I'll talk a little bit about the discussions that have been taking place around a personal learning environment, which I understand is of interest to this center. And I'll also talk to some degree about my own work, specifically in what I have been calling learning networks. And again, a distributed approach to online learning. And then I'll try to pull it together, and we'll see how that goes. Sometimes it pulls together, and sometimes it doesn't. That's basically my plan. I will say, though, like I said earlier, interrupt or ask questions at any time. Also, if you don't like to talk, tell me to talk about something else. I mean, I will adapt and change what I'm talking about to meet your interest, because I'm here to meet your needs so far as getting information and conversation is concerned. So if you would rather talk about something else or follow a particular line of inquiry or anything like that, I'm very open to that. This is not a pre-recorded presentation. You know, I'm actually here in person, which means that the dialogue and the interaction is an important part of what happens. So I do want you to feel free to take part in this. Although I will have to give you the microphone, I guess. So I'm sorry about that, but I'm just kidding. So how does that sound as a plan, roughly? Alright, we got, for the net record, we got an actual thumbs up. Often I say, how do you like, how's that for a plan? I get complete silence, and I just look and say, Nate, and then finally, you know, time ticks, and then someone goes, it's hard to get people. It's funny. It's we're so enculturated, aren't we, to this broadcast presentation mode? And I'm thinking, it's funny. Like, I talk about teaching as being modeling and demonstrating. People talk about teaching as a transfer of information, but I don't see it that way. And I think about, you know, even when I come and do a talk, like, I'm propagating the way that I learned. And if I'm demonstrating, it's like now I'm demonstrating this old-fashioned way. I can talk all I want, but if you look at what I'm doing, I'm sitting here at the front of the classroom broadcasting. So, and it's funny how we just fall into that. So naturally we fall into that mode, and how hard it is to get that discussion and that interaction going sometimes. So I especially with a larger room, this room will be easier because it's a smaller group, but I sometimes do these talks for, you know, several hundred people, and it's really hard to have a conversation with several hundred people. Not because everyone wants to talk, but interestingly because nobody wants to talk. I was going to put pictures on the nice title pages, but I ran out of time. This is an approach I took in Toronto, and I want to explore this approach again, because I think that part of what's happening with this new technology is that for people who have grown up with this technology, or for people who have immersed themselves into this technological world, they are actually seeing something different than what people who grew up or use more traditional media do. Now, you know, it's understood and well known and well accepted that when we perceive something, when we look at something, we bring something of ourselves into what we see. Anytime we look at something, there's an interpretation happening. You don't just see something. You see something as something. If I see a bear, I see it as a bear. But if you grew up never seeing or having heard of a bear, you would not see it as a bear. You'd see it as a big dog or something like that. Now, when somebody who grew up with newspapers and books and television and radio looks at a computer, as you can see, what they see when they look at the computer is a representation of that old media. They see words. they see sentences, they see paragraphs, and they, I say they, you know, half the time when I look at a computer, I see words, I see pictures, I might see some video. In other words, when I look at the computer, the sort of interpretation that goes through my mind is the same sort of interpretation I would bring through, bring to traditional media. And that's what makes, in my mind, the online media, for the more traditional mind, almost unreal, right? Because it seems like it's one step removed from what I would think of as something real. But that's simply my argument here. It's simply a function of our unfamiliarity with the technology. I have many ways of seeing the world in my ordinary day-to-day life. I see the world through a mirror. I wake up in the morning, I look in the mirror, I go, ah! And then I look at the mirror some more, and I see myself, and I see myself as being real. Or if I look at something through a telescope, I look at a star or the window in the apartment building, I see that as something real. When I call somebody on my telephone, I don't think it's a virtual person on the other end. I think that I'm talking to a real person. It's just my comfort with the technology. Well, when you are immersed in this online world, the things that you see and experience in this online world are real. And my own experience with that came from the world of online games. Most people my age, when they started with the internet, they started with things like email, which is text, right? Or they started with the Usenet news groups, which is, you know, text messages. I started with online games, MUDs, multi-user dungeons. These are multiplayer text-based role-playing games on the internet. So when I went online, I would interact not only with the text, but also with other people who were playing the same game and in the same environment. And I knew, even from the very early days, that I was interacting with real people. And people who are online now, today, they know that they're interacting with real people, that it's not virtual, it's not at some level removed, but it's actual people that they talk to. The massive multiplayer online role-playing games, for example, or PORGs, or I can't pronounce that. I guess it wouldn't be PORGs. Whatever. But, you know, you go into that environment, you see these animations, but that's a person. And it's, you relate to what you are seeing differently when you're seeing that is a person as compared to that is a picture. Or you relate to something differently. You relate to a piece of text differently when you see that piece of text as representing a person as compared to representing a paragraph from a book. It's a different perspective and a different point of view. I'm going to need water or something like that if I'm going to keep talking. I'm sorry. I don't mean to. Anyhow. What do we see? Now, this is why I like having the internet. Okay. This is a mental exercise. I want you to go through this mental exercise with me. When you are browsing a website, I want you to abstract from the images, abstract from the text, and think about now what is being presented to your mind. And this is a representation. I hope this pops up properly. It's going to sit there and not do anything. Why not? Probably because I got way too much stuff open. La-dee-da-dee-da. All right, there we go. This is you, eventually. This should be faster. All right, okay, I'm going to have to type in my own. Now, imagine yourself going to my website. What is your browsing experience like? I seem to have stalling here. I'm waiting for this site to come up. I guess it has become very popular recently. And you see nothing. I've had people say that to me. Now, this is you browsing. This is what you're seeing. This is what your mind is doing, right? It's one thing connected to another, connected to another, connected to another, connected to another. And what's important is, again, there are different ways of seeing this. If you are coming at this from a traditional point of view, you're seeing connected content, right? You're focused on the connection of this resource to this resource, this resource to this resource. But if what you are seeing when you look on the web is people, the way somebody who grew up with the web, each of those blue dots is a link to somewhere else. Each of those blue dots is a link to some website, to some other person. When you look at one person's website, you see not just content, you see a network. Your point of view, your perspective is to see that as a network, as a community, as a culture, as a way of seeing the world, as a network of interactions, as a distributed base of knowledge. All of those things are what you see when you see a website. And you don't see it discreetly, point, 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 point. You see it overall as an image or a snapshot. This is a really hard concept, but it's a crucial concept. Now, why did I end up back here? Oh, I hate my... No. Ta-da! I'm getting good at this. Now, some of you just recently took part in a workshop on social network analysis. The stuff that you did on social network analysis ties directly into what I'm saying there. And I'm sloughing off, bracketing a whole lot of discussion on that. But I'm after the same thing. Based on that, we can draw ways of distinguishing between traditional media and new media. And the way I draw this distinction is not in the media itself so much as in our perception or our way of seeing the media. So traditional media, we look at traditional media as being linear. We expect one thing to follow after another. But new media, as we just saw, is multidimensional. Things may be linear. Things may come at us at the same time. Things may be widely separated in time. A good example of that is an online chat. If you've ever participated in an online chat, and you might be talking about something, you might have two or three distinct threads of conversation going on in the same chat space. And sometimes you actually draw links between those two or three distinct threads of conversation. Or if you're a typical person who grew up online, you'll be having a conversation with one person and another with another person and another with another person all at the same time. And you know that all these other people are talking to each other too. And so you'll actually cross-reference your conversations. Traditional media is composed. By that, what I mean is, it's like Legos. The pieces fit together like blocks. A whole is composed of parts. But new media or hypermedia, you don't create a whole out of parts. The parts remain separate and distinct, but they are connected to each other. Specifically and technically, a change of state in one can result in a change of state in another. That's what I mean by connected. Traditional media describes the semantical relationship between traditional media and the world is not direct. It's indirect. It's precisely a semantical relationship. Snow is white if and only if snow is white. There is not a causal relationship between the sentence and the snow, but an inferred one, one that needs to be verified independently through observation or experimentation. Hypermedia represents. It is a direct result of whatever it is describing. The diagram that you saw with all the links and the dots, that isn't simply a representation of my site, but it actually is connected to and caused by the organization of my site. For those of you who are into epistemology, think along those lines of Gibson and direct perception. Traditional media is static. We print stuff on paper, we put the book in a library, we expect it to have a life, a shelf life, quite literally. We create an online course, or for CD or for internet, and we expect it to be valid for days, weeks, months, years. Online media is dynamic. We do not expect the internet to be the same tomorrow as it is today. We do not expect the internet to be the same in 10 minutes as it is today. But importantly, it's not just the content that's dynamic, it's actually the state or nature of knowledge itself that is dynamic. You know, we grew up thinking knowledge is, you know, is and always will be, all right? But knowledge is actually something that changes from day to day, from minute to minute. And in a very practical sense, you can see that this is true. Something that was not true a few minutes ago is now true. It's like the tense logic built into our epistemology. There's a relation, a very important relation, between how we see this structure on the internet and how people who live in this world see themselves. And we can see this through an examination of the artifacts that they put online. Dana Boyd, for example, talks about MySpace, and some of you may have seen this article that she wrote not too long ago, and says specifically, and I believe accurately, that a place like MySpace is a place where people create an identity for themselves, or more accurately, I would say, how do I want to say it? I don't want to say create a facade of an identity, because that's not quite right, but create a face that they present to the world. I say it like that because there's no requirement, no necessity that we have only one identity, and there's no requirement, no necessity that this identity that is created be in some sense grounded. It is indeed an artifact. And I've seen this and experienced this for myself, again, growing up with these online games, these MUDs, where a person would come into a MUD, and again, this is a multiplayer online environment, and they would adapt a role or a way of conducting themselves. And you could see, especially among the younger players, how they'd come into one of these environments and try out an identity. And it might not work because, you know, they're not very good at interacting with people yet. So they go away and come on a few weeks later as a new character, try a new type of identity. I saw some people go through 3 or 4 identities before they settled on one. They'd change, you know, everything. Name, they'd change, you know, you could be an orc or an elf or whatever, and they'd change that. And, you know, they often, sometimes even change genders, you know. Oh, I think I'll try being female today. And it's funny, the males would try being female and they would go back to being male because they got too many messages from other males. They weren't comfortable with that. This is the main perception males get when they act as females online is, oh, all these. My online name was Labatt. That's funny. People have perceptions about the gender of a person based on their name. Labatt, that's a very soft sounding name. Lots of males thought that I was female. So, and even when I started calling myself Labatt the cat, and it didn't help at all. It made it worse. Yeah. The only thing I could have done that would have been worse than Labatt the Pussycat or something. But, you know, but if I was like Labatt the Dragon, I would have been fine. Perception, eh? Now, think, I want you to put these two concepts together now. The concepts you saw of my website with all the links and that to my network and all of that, and the idea of my website, my web presentation, being a presentation of myself, it follows, and you can run through it, that my website is in an important sense a description of myself, right? Which means that a description of myself consists at least in part, and some would argue more than just in part, in that social network in which I am embedded online, this real social network, remember. But take that one logical step further. Remember, my website, the structure of my website is isomorphic to, similar to, the same as, logically, what happens when you browse my website, if we abstract from the contents, which means your pattern of viewing something like my website is a way of you representing yourself. I think this is an important and key concept. What we do on the web, what we do in the internet, establishes our own identity. And if you think about it, what else would be the case? What else could be the case? Our identity is at least in part composed of the network of people we read, the contents of the writing that we read, the pictures that we see, and we see these all as real persons that have a direct causal relation with our own state of being, our own understanding of ourselves. Now, should be the next slide here. Oh, okay, this draws this out a little bit. When we look through the network, when we look through the internet, we are creating networks just as surely as though we were creating websites. And indeed, this is literally true, not metaphorically true. It's literally true. If you take your browser history, which can be represented in HTML, and is easily visible. Do I want to show you this? Ah, what? if you see any bad sites, pretend you didn't see them. There's my browsing history. I could take that, right-click, pop it on my website, and it's now a website. My browsing history is a website. Yeah, it'll come up later in the talk, actually. Interesting. I told you, don't... Never mind. Oh, okay, good enough, I see. Yeah. Right. I've mentioned this before, but there's two ways you can have PowerPoint on your computer, right? Either like this, where it's the sort of small picture of the slide that you're working on, or the big, large presentation. So, and then we have icons representing the two possible states. There's a small one, and then there's the big, large one. How come the small icon matches the large presentation, and the large icon matches the small presentation? I ask you. That's an aside. When we look at a computer, when we work with a computer, if we are reflective, we see ourselves. That's why online learning and how we set up online learning is so important. Because the more structured an online learning experience is, the more our own perception of identity is being managed by another party. Theories of online learning, approaches, pedagogies, technologies of online learning have to capture this. They have to capture the expression of self in an online environment as a network of connections. We need to understand that the way we set up learning online will change or will impact on our own perception of self. And so, and I say it like this, the more controlled that experience is, the more our own development of our own identity, our own perception of self, is in the hands of a third party, and therefore the riskier that becomes. As Radical Norm talked about the other day, there's the sense in which our identity is influenced by our media, and in a corporate media environment, our identity is molded and shaped by these corporate images. I'm part of the Pepsi generation, right? Whatever. I'm not really. I always preferred Coke, the real thing. I like to say Coke is the new Pepsi of the O'Keefe generation. Yes. I had a brand conflict over lunch today because people ordered Budweiser, and I'm thinking, oh, these are water like American beer. There's a brand conflict. My head wasn't ready to deal with that. If learning is identity, then crucially, when we describe the learning experience, we have to put the self at the center of the learning experience. Yes.
May I ask a question?
Yes, absolutely.
You started out with mentioning virtual reality, and you were questioning what is real and what is virtual. Have you ever thought of turning this term around and talk about real virtuality? Because I think it's worth playing with this a bit, since our identity and the way we live, of course, includes a lot of virtual images.
Sure.
And if we are told tales as children, we discover the world, or we reflect the world, which is told to us in terms of a virtual story.
Right.
It's not true, but it's relevant and it's real. So it might be useful to get rid of this virtual reality myth by saying there's a lot of virtuality in our reality anyway.
Yeah, I have no difficulty with that line of reasoning. That's very consistent with this approach. In some of my talks, not this one, sadly, but in some of my, well, I guess it's going to be part of it now, I talk about how each of us perceives the same thing differently. And the reason why we perceive the same thing differently is precisely because of that background knowledge, that background environment that we grow up in. And I very frequently in my talks use the example of the word Paris. And people think of the word Paris, and I ask people to think of the word Paris, right? And I ask, you know, how many of you thought of France? So let me ask, how many of you thought of France when I said the word Paris? All right, so about 3/4 of the room. How many of you thought of Paris Hilton? Radical Norm. Right. How many of you thought of Plaster of Paris? None. You see, and I almost always think of Plaster of Paris because I used to work with Plaster of Paris when I was a kid, right? So,
but I think in some ways maybe your point is that the new media is not so new. That the version that people have mentioned, because I think that probably about 3 or 4 of the points that you talked about the new media. I mean, you could identify that stuff in Tristram Shandy, or you could identify it in fiction overall.
Sure.
So I don't think that, like, for example, books are people, right? There's books themselves that are written about how authors are constructed in text, etc. So there's a whole bunch of points about how there's lots of continuity between new media and old media.
I agree. And we've all had this experience. We go to visit a friend, and we look at their bookshelf, and we construct a picture of who they are based on what's on their bookshelf. And then reflective people they know this. So they go out and they buy books specifically for their bookshelf, right? And that's how I came to have like the full Shakespeare, right? Right. And they're constructing their identity by populating their bookshelf, right? But in a more literal sense, what they read, the stories they read, and for that matter, the stories they hear, become who they are. This is not new, I agree. And then, you know, I mean, no, I mean, not even Descartes came up with completely original stuff. I mean, this builds on that. But the point is, it's important to recognize that this holds in the online world. That, you have people like Dreyfus say, you know, like the online world, you know, you can't have this online experience because there are no consequences to your actions, right? Because there's no causal relation between what happens online and your own life. And what I'm saying here is, no, that's not true. There is a causal relation.
Obviously, you're not
doing
online
banking. Yeah, well, exactly. or worse, online gambling. Yeah. So, all this being the case, and the, you know, the same motivation is behind some of the more traditional pedagogies, we have to place the self very clearly and with recognition that we're doing this at the center of the learning experience. But what's also important is this is very different from more traditional, more typical theories of distance learning. Like, look at, this is, I'm just picking one out of the air, but this is Terry Anderson's, well, I think of it as Terry Anderson's, although, of course, he's working with other people as well. And it's an advance over the old Moore-type theory, where instead of mere interaction, they're presenting different types of presence, right? You know, the social presence, the cognitive presence, and the teaching presence, and these all form a part of what Anderson and the others characterize as the educational experience. Now, can we talk about whether something is social, cognitive, whether, you know, does a book count as a social presence or a teaching presence, all of that sort of stuff, but let's rewrite this, right? And we rewrite this first in the demonstration that I already gave you explicitly, right? We're not talking presence per se in the online world. We're talking network, right? Because presence is one thing, but it's the network that is what we perceive, this set of connections between entities. And most importantly, the center is euphemistically called educational experience, which typically is taken to mean something like the course or the module or the lesson, or, you know, if you have a wide view, the learning institution or the institutional presentation of learning. The center instead is the self. So our picture, what I've done now is I've taken the Anderson theory and morphed it, right? Of course, there's no way Anderson's going to support this now, but adding the observations I've taken so far to what they say, now we have the self at the center, we have a social network, and a cognitive network, and a teaching network. And there's probably plenty of room for inquiry, and people probably will do this at some point, you know, what constitutes the social network? Well, you've seen some of that already, but there is an analogous and equally important cognitive network, and an analogous and equally important teaching network, which, you know, might be the peers and the mentors and the apprenticeships, etc. And then we make this explicit, and we get that picture that you know, my website, myself, my identity, my teaching networks, my learning environment becomes my identity. So this is the background. This is the theoretical background to the approach that I take. It's a bit of a slog because, again, it was only 1 hour, or even less maybe. I don't know how much time is gone, but this is the approach that I think underlies and is vital to any approach that we take in online learning technology. That if we are going to design learning technology, we need to have this picture with the self at the center and the network of connections surrounding it, rather than some course-based or even worse, institution-based approach to online learning. So I'm going to pause for just a second now. Depending on the audience, sometimes this is where the howls of protest begin. How am I in time, by the way?
It's 5 to 3, sir.
5 to 3. So we're about halfway through. That was section one. I have five sections. I always do this. Now we're good.
One issue that comes up in assessing working with representations of statistics or whatever of people have done online, you know, how, whether you want to view that as them sort of constructing their identity or whatever, is that you can't. It's like that type of information sort of tells you something about, like, objectively quantitatively what happened, but
right.
There's no qualitative kind of connotations there at all. Right? So if a student clicked through the whole course, like maybe they were talking to somebody on the computer next to them and they really weren't looking much at what they were doing. Or the classic thing is they log on and leave it on all day and they've been reading postings for the first, you know, 24 hours.
In the world of MUDs, people would write scripts and they would feed into their MUD client and they'd launch the scripts and the script would have their character go through a room, kill the monster, get the gold. Go to a room, kill the monster, get the gold. And they gain experience points by doing that. Same sort of thing. I want to be clear. I think that's a valid point. I'm not talking about the creation or understanding of self as some sort of quantitative measure of the sites that you've gone to. Okay? This is not an objective assessment kind of thing. All right? This is a way of pointing to the perspective or way in which we see the world. Okay? The distinction is, it's like the distinction between, when I look outside that window and see that flower, I could measure all the photons that are coming in. And it's going to be important to talk about those photons coming in to understand that I'm seeing a flower. But my experience of seeing the flower is not reducible to those photons coming in, right? My seeing the flower, even when I'm talking about the photons, I'm trying to get at the role that they play in the way I see the flower as a flower. I know that's awkward. Is that helping?
So what you're saying in some way though that it's qualified. It's meant in a very particular qualified way.
Yeah, it's meant in a very particular qualified way. I absolutely do not mean that the counting up of sites you see is some objective description of the self or even any attribute of the self.
Or even a very rich and accurate description of, like, you were here first and here's that page. Yeah. And then
doesn't, yeah, no. That is not the same as who you are, right? That is the raw material that from a certain point of view looked at a certain way can give you a qualitative experience. I am so-and-so, right? That's like the atoms, and you see Richard Nixon. Well, history will interpret those words, maybe. section two.
Just the picture that you also showed before, the one that was, you know, when you type in your own website and then the network was created.
Right.
Is that open to that too with any other one? Or
yes, you can, yeah. And
the artist can have these pictures in Twitter.
Well,
yeah.
It's all now on those, yeah, you know, like Wikipedia, how far it is connected as well, but I don't think anyone that does it actually, you know.
Yeah, but you can go to that site. These slides will be on my website later today, assuming I can play with the internet for a bit later. And you can go to that page and go to that site. Try it with any website at all. It's very interesting. Actually, you try it with different sites, and you see the different ways the different sites are constructed. Although I will point out that those maps are not an actual description of the site, but rather they're a description of the site based on sequential access. Like if you were to graph my site, this is why these things struck me so much, because I ran it on my site and I looked at it and I said, no, that's not what my site looks like, because my site is much more densely connected than that, or very deliberately. And then I realized what I'm looking at is not a representation of my site. I realized I was looking at a representation of how someone sees my site. A very different thing. And that's kind of what made it all click to me. Oh, right. How I see the site is one thing. The site itself is another. How I see the site has its own independent existence. And then I asked, well, existence, but of what? And then I realized, how I see the site reflects me, not the site. I think that's so important.
But then I think in these pictures you sometimes, well, it has to be, you have to know what is calculated, because in terms of, you know, closeness or, you know, which one is centrality, it also depends on what kind of centrality
is calculated.
It could be very different things, and so it depends if it's, you know, betweenness or what kind of centrality is measured that could give you a complete different picture again.
Yeah, I should do that. I should start with my newsletter page or my threads page or something. Seb, you had a...
Yeah, I just wanted to come back to an earlier remark. You said something along the lines that if we put in more structure, the more structure that is put into these kind of environments, the less individual expression of self is allowed.
Right.
Or is possible.
Or is created, yes.
So, you know, when I talk to the students, this workshop in Innsbruck, you know, I ask them what kind of system they use, and they of course have their LMS, and I mean, again, we get the story that these things are not used, you know, and it's like, there's a forum, but nobody is there, and you know, the hen and egg problem, I go there, nothing is happening, so I don't come back, blah, 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 blah,
yep.
And very often, you know, you will see explanatory attempts of saying, oh, you know, the interface is not good enough, and blah, 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 blah. Do you actually think that this lack of self-expression is sometimes a cause or an influential factor of people not taking these things up?
I would say it's the cause, actually, not just simply, well, I mean, maybe there are other causes, but I mean, my observation is if people want to get somewhere, the interface is not a factor. People will live through really bad interfaces to get to things that they want. And that's been, I think, reasonably established. I mean, go to Slashdot. I mean, you know, the Slashdot interface is awful. But it's still visited by thousands of people. I've seen sites that are slow, but people still go there. By contrast, you can have the best interface in the world, but if nobody wants to, you know, nobody values what's there, nobody's going to go there. I think ownership is crucial. I think that...
Perceived ownership, I think.
I think perceived. I think you're quite right when you say that. It's later on in the slides, but Brian Lamb sets up these wikis and that for students at the University of British Columbia. Actually, they could go in, they could do whatever they want. It is an open space for them, but the students say, no, we don't want to use these sites that are hosted by UBC because they don't feel like ours, that, you know, they're institutional. And there's the perception, which may be or may not be, we don't know, grounded in reality, that the institution could clamp down, that the institution could claim ownership, you know, and yeah, and it's a subtle thing, you know, and you see these online communities where, you know, even the subtle change in how people perceive the ownership of the site is being managed, It changes the entire dynamics. I remember, in fact, I wrote an article once many years ago called Selling the Well. The Well, of course, was one of these original online communities, and it was felt to be a community. But then when the site was sold, the internal dynamics changed. And it's funny because there was no change in management or policy or anything like that. you know, the only thing that changed was, you know, who collects the money. But the perception on the part of the members just did a complete 180, and their attitude toward the community changed completely. So, we have out there, and as a result of our discussion so far, two different models of online environment. And you know, these are really generalized pictures. And, you know, there are a lot of variation in between. They're caricatures intended to draw out the point. Is that coffee?
Yes.
Thank you. let the online world be aware that I do like my coffee. And we've seen these models, right? One model is the centralized model, where all the different services and resources, etc., are hosted in a single place, and the people log into this and access these things. One example of such a site is Yahoo, right? Where you have your Yahoo login, and then you go to Yahoo Games or Yahoo Groups or Yahoo whatever, well, Flickr these days. Another example, a very common example, is the typical university computing environment, right, where you log in and you know, you access the LMS or the student registration system or the sports calendar or whatever you're accessing. It depends on the university. The other model is a distributed model, where the resources are separate. Different people manage different resources, and it's characterized as a network of connections or relations between the different resources. Is that a question? Or
no.
No? Okay. Just checking out. I like to be attentive.
Well, that is a very suggestive picture.
Okay.
You're trying to tell that in the first place you don't have a network, and in the second case you have a network.
That's right.
It has nothing to do with each other. So just a question of how people use these environments.
I don't think so. I mean, when you go to Yahoo, there isn't a network there. It's a single service.
We're using, for example, we have one development community dealing with a simple query interface. We're using Yahoo group. Its network is working. It's just using one of these centralized services.
If you're using one of these centralized services, then it's not a network. It's a single centralized service. You can call it a network all you want, but for it to be a network, it has to be separated things that communicate. I'll list some properties. Match the properties of your system to the properties I list, and ask yourself, are we satisfying these properties? If you're not satisfying these properties, it doesn't matter what words you use. So a little more on centralized environments. And to me, the paradigm case of centralized versus distributed environments is before and after the web. Before the web, we had these online services like CompuServe, Prodigy, Genie, America Online, etc. And you would go to them, just like you go to Yahoo today, you'd log on to them, they had their own proprietary login, they had their own proprietary data format, and importantly, they did not talk to each other. CompuServe did not talk to Prodigy. Prodigy did not talk to Genie. These were separate environments. They were, to use today's parlance, silos. And then along comes the web. And the web consists of, the web is not a single silo, but it's a whole bunch of web servers all over the place. And these web servers, they're located in different places. Importantly, they're run by different people. And yet, the same protocol is used to access them, right? TCP/IP, and then HTTP, and then HTML to represent the content, right? The same protocol. And one website, well, it's not there anymore, but one website is linked to another, which is what makes it a network rather than a whole bunch of things. Traditional online learning, right? is this centralized model. It's institution-based, it's online courses, so it's content-based in a learning management system with, you know, this proprietary institution-based logon. Even when they work together, it's closed, right? The content federations or the identity federations, these are still closed networks. It's still a monolithic university system. It's product-based. Think back to the first section, ways of seeing, right? It's based on content. It's based on text. It's based on images. You actually package the contents as though it were static and presented. It could be online. It could be on a CD-ROM. It doesn't matter, right? It's sequenced. It's organized. You run the whole courseware thing. It's old. It's old media centric is the way I would say it, from the point of view of that first section. And the distributed environment, as I said, the paradigm case is the World Wide Web, the DNS, HTTP, TCP/IP being the things that link these things all together, and with a distributed system, as I say here on this slide, this integration, the making the different things work together is always going to be the major issue. In learning, and this is where we're looking to the future, to the thing that doesn't exist yet, a distributed system falls under the heading of what I call learning networks, where the organization of learning as a whole is not institution-based. Rather, I don't even want to say it's resource-based. Pretend that slide doesn't say that. But it's based more on the connection, the movement, the way I say it in some other presentations, it's like conversations between students and between instructors, between people working in communities of practice, where these resources, web posts, images, blogs, whatever, are like the vocabulary that people use to exchange their thoughts and ideas back and forth together. It's not product-based in the sense that learning isn't something that's packaged and put on a shelf and consumed. It's rather it moves through the system. It's drawn. I'd put the word aggregated here, where it's out there in the network, and then a person will bring in for themselves that part of the network that they want. It's a lot like browsing websites, except you bring the content to yourself. It's more of an interaction with the material, indeed more an interaction with the people who are out there in the network than a relation between a person and some sort of learning content. I know this is all pretty vague and fuzzy, and the next section or so is going to actually put this into more concrete form. George Siemens has characterized a lot of this under the heading of connectivism, and the idea that knowledge and learning takes place in a distributed environment. He, I believe, and I certainly characterize learning on this model as, that's the smoker heading out. I guess I lied about that break. Actually, I tried to slough it off and give it to someone else to manage, but that's right. Okay, never mind. I'll be okay. Anyhow, where was I? Oh, yes, connectivism, the knowledge and learning is the embedding of oneself in the conversations that characterize a community of practice. Demonstrating successful learning in this case would be something like being able to converse or interact meaningfully within that community of practice. And there's a lot packed into that sentence. I've looked at connectivism from the point of view of epistemology and in some presentations drawn out four major principles that characterize successful networks. And those are, as you can see on the slide, autonomy, which is choice and control for the learner, diversity, openness, and interaction. The next section is actually a longer, more detailed list. That's why I'm not lingering on these right here. And to be honest, I'm a little bit ambivalent about what principles characterize a successful network, which I know sounds like really awful from an academic point of view, because you know, you're supposed, you come, you present a theory, you're supposed to have everything like nailed down and defined and definitive. But I think that what constitutes the characteristics of a successful network is an empirical matter. And I'm reporting on what my observations are to this point, and I'm not sure how well that this has been measured to this point. It seems to me that these four things are the most crucial, but I think in different contexts, other things will come into play as well. I'll talk about these briefly in the next section. I know that this section is a lot of hand-waving, but it will be concrete. Go ahead.
Just ask a question already. So do you really believe that there's this one correct or the one best network, so to say, for learning purposes?
I don't think there's one best anything of anything. I sometimes ask myself, and I had this discussion with George Siemens online a few months ago, and I ask myself, what prevents my perspective, my point of view, from falling into complete unadulterated relativism, right? Where I can't draw any distinction between anything, good, evil, all the same, true, false, all the same. And you look at people like Ronald Geary and there's someone else, I forget who, but various writers looking at the philosophy of science. And what in the philosophy of science, what constitutes the best theory is a rough and ready set of methodological principles. When you're evaluating the effectiveness of a scientific explanation, for example, things like Occam's razor come into play. The scientists tend to prefer the simple explanation, and things like the spectrum of coverage. People prefer theories that explain lots of things rather than theories that explain few things. And verification, not the logical positivist kind of verification, but again, rough and ready. You can use this theory to make predictions. And my approach to networks is similarly kind of like loose. Networks that allow for autonomy of individual members of the network tend, it seems to me, probably maybe for most purposes good enough to be better networks. Right? Now, is this an absolute rule? Probably not. Right? And similarly with diversity and openness and interaction. So none of these things become absolute principles. Now, it's like freedom, right? Like, people talk about freedom, and we talk about freedom in my country, and freedom of speech, and freedom of speech does not include hate speech. And it does not include speech acts, like shouting fire in a movie theater, right? But freedom of speech is something that would characterize a successful society, and would, in my characterization, fall under the heading of openness, right? But it doesn't, by that virtue, become an absolute. I don't think any of these things become absolute. They all play off against each other. And it depends on your perspective, what you're up to, your point of view. Think of it as pragmatism combined with methodological procedurism, functionalism, whatever, and relativism. If anybody ever studies my work in the future, they will hate me for what I just said. But because there isn't really a theory here. But that's important. That's what we need to understand, right? There isn't going to be a theory. It's going to be rough and ready like this. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, because as you were just saying before, like, you know, something about, you know, the Google or the best network, and this mm-hmm. is what I was doubting, because I was thinking there's the best yeah. network.
It's like, you know, suppose I said my favorite city is Vienna, right? Now, does that mean I want to spend the rest of my life always and only in Vienna? Well, no. But does that mean that when I'm in Paris that my favorite city is no longer Vienna? Well, no, right? You see what I mean? It can be the best and yet not be the one that's the most useful at this point. If that makes, you know, sense. It's like that. You know, people have this thing about natural laws that or principles in general that they ought to be like universal generalizations, and personally I think that was one of the biggest mistakes that has ever been made in philosophy, this whole concept of the universal generalization, because I can't think of anything that is universally true, even that sentence. And only a philosopher can get away with saying something like that.
And one thing that's all like openness. Mm-hmm. What makes a good network is not always openness, it also might be disclosure, the ability to do something in a well-protected context like we have usually in learning situations like universities, where people are kind of protected by their institution. They can make the most stupid faults without having any kind of that. And
yeah, well, I hear that all the time, okay, and I hear that in two contexts, and it's very interesting. The one context I hear that in is in schools, right, and the other context I hear that in is in business and politics, and the argument is the same in both cases, that in these closed environments, people could say things that they would not say in the open environment, and for the most part, that's not true. In the learning environment, as the work in blogging suggests, and you can find references to this throughout the blogosphere, when people produce work that is read by a wider audience, that creates a greater motivation to do good work, as would be expected. And consequently, people's accomplishments in an open environment rather than a closed environment are greater. And, you know, I saw this for myself when I went to the Institut Saint-Joseph in Quebec City and talked with the instructors and the students there. And what was important to them was, in fact, the fact that people outside the institution were reading it. You know, it's the one story that was in my article. It was the kids, they're grade 5, right, so they're very young. They went to see a circus, and then they wrote about the circus in their blog, and someone from the circus that had moved on to another city saw it and wrote back to them, and it just created this whole ripple through the class. So pedagogically, there isn't this ground for keeping these things closed. And I think that, you know, I mean, I moved to this other context, that this, you know, political and business context. And again, like, I've sat on boards of governors of a couple of universities. And, you know, these boards, like most of these boards, insist on having their meetings in secret. And I would sit on these boards and argue that the meeting should be open. And the other members of the board say, well, you know, having the meeting closed allows us to say things that we wouldn't say if it was open. And I asked them, well, in which case are you lying? In the open session or the closed session? Because when you argue that way for having something closed, what you're arguing for is the capacity to say one thing in public and another thing in private, aren't you? And if you're saying one thing in public and another thing in private, then either you're lying publicly or you're lying privately. So it's a license to lie. And a network in which a significant amount of the information is false is not a successful network, in my opinion. So that's how I respond to that.
What do you mean by successful, in your opinion? There's thriving networks that are full of false crap.
Alright.
I mean, just look at the Republican Party in the U.S. and Fox News.
Yeah.
They're not classic networks when you're discovering.
You know, I wrote not too long ago, in fact, it was my presentation in London, that we should be open and share without reservation, and somebody out there in the blogosphere said, but he must have some doubts about that, because he never shared what he did, or you know, why he took a hiatus. But it was exactly that question, right? What is a successful network? Became, in my mind, what is the point of what we're doing, right? Why are we doing any of this stuff at all? Why are we in learning? Why are we in social policy? Why are we in this room here now? What are we up to? What's the purpose of it? Why do we get up in the morning? Okay? And I answered that question eventually, and I said this in Tennessee for those who were still reading what I was writing by that point, that the purpose of an education is to have a good life. Now, what is a good life? Well, there's no such thing as the answer to that question, right? I draw from John Stuart Mill. To pursue one's own good in one's own way. What is a successful network is a set of connections with other people and resources and events and whatever that allows yourself to maximally pursue one's own good in one's own way. So, these are the principles that, to me, enable that. In other words, I believe that my life and the lives of other people will be better if I'm able to make the decisions involving it myself. I believe that my life will be better and other people's lives will be better if I can express myself in my own way, if diversity is supported. I believe that my life will be better if I can express myself and if I can read the expressions of others. And that my life will be better if I can interact, connect with, form association with other people. And I don't think that it's a coincidence that these four principles match very closely to statements of principles of rights in various constitutions. Because what we're up to in an open society is what we're up to in an online open communications network. And so I think that the underlying principles are going to be very similar. So that's how I answer the question. And that's as good an answer as I'm likely to ever get. And I don't think, you know, and again, you know, people want these sharp, crisp theories, but it doesn't work that way. And, you know, because you define your own good your own way, what you mean by autonomy, what you mean by diversity, is going to shade subtly different from mine. And the more distinct your culture and your heritage is, the more that is going to be. What counts as diversity for somebody in the Muslim world is going to be very different from what counts as diversity for somebody in Canada or somebody in Austria, I would say. How is that? It's about as good as I can do. And you might be thinking, how none of this resolves itself technologically, but it does. If these principles make sense to you, and if you more or less agree to them, and this is the thing, everything else falls out of this. From this point, everything becomes deduction. All right, You know, we basically... I think so. I think once we're here, the rest of the stuff pretty much falls out. Let me draw out these principles. I'm going to zip through this section because we are running out of time. And I want you to see some of the stuff that falls out. So, again, these aren't hard and fast principles. They're sensible design principles. Think of them as rules of thumb more than universal laws of nature. Here they are. First principle, and again, this is like that set of four principles, except there's 8 or 10 of them. And I know that doesn't make sense. I'm saying the same thing here as I did with those four principles. Like I said, they're not absolutes. But remember, you were talking about before, I said, you know, compare your system with the principles, compare your approach with these principles now. And in my view, if it's not like this, it's not a network. Okay? Decentralized. If it's not decentralized, it's not a network. Conversely, if it is centralized, it's probably not a network. Or if it is a network, it's a dysfunctional network. Right? You can have networks that have this characteristic star shape. You know, the one thing at the center, and then everything shoots off from that. You know, those networks are actually isomorphic to hierarchical systems, right? And you can map that out. Whereas a decentralized network, when you map it out, it will look more characteristically like a mesh rather than a bunch of stars in your diagram. Even my website, when we saw that diagram, looked like a bunch of stars. But I've characterized this and discussed this. I talked about this particular principle at some length in my paper, Community Blogging. And that was a reaction to this whole discussion of the long tail. And you would have last weekend heard about discussion of scale-free networks and things like that. And there's this Clay Shirky and all of those. There's this group of people out there on the web, characterized mostly by being A-list bloggers, who say that the long tail is the natural order of things. And, of course, implicit in that statement is that the big spike is part of the natural order of things. And they, of course, are members of the big spike. And my argument here is that this is not a natural order of things, that it's the sort of thing that can happen in a scale-free network, but when we look at networks as we see them in the environment, usually there's a limiting factor that prevents the big spike from being millions of times larger than elements in the long tail. In other words, networks in nature, such as, say, a food web or something like that, look more like a mesh than they do this star shape. Second, distributed. The idea here is that there's no single location for resources, or for that matter, people in the network. That the different components of the network are in different places. And the idea here is that content, if you will, generally rests or resides at its place of creation or some place like that, and is transferred to the place where it's needed rather than replicated and copied. Think of your television, right? Your television does not contain all of the programs from all of the networks just in case you might happen to need one. And nobody would design a television that way, right? A television, when you turn it on and turn to a channel, it gets the signal that it needs at that point in time, and it just ignores the rest. In a similar manner, right? Google. Well, maybe that's a bad example because there's Google Cache, but even so, even with Google Cache, when you use Google to search, right, and then you access a web page, you access the web page where it is, right, and you know, with the exception of Google Cache is interesting, but Yeah, I have to think about that. But it's still a good thing. We would never have designed the web in such a way that every web page that exists has to be on one big, huge server located in, I don't know, where. Where would you put it?
New York.
New York? World Trade Center? Yeah, let's put it in the biggest building in the world. Yeah, it'll be safe there. Right? We wouldn't do it. We wouldn't have designed it that way. But it's distributed. It's in different places. Imagine if we organized people that way, right? All the people in the world have to live in one big city. New York. This one I'm less sure of, but I still think this is right. Disintermediation. This one ties into openness. And what it is a breaking down of the barrier between the producer of something and the consumer or the receiver of something. And we've seen this at work in the whole phenomenon of blogging and all of that on the web. Where we've really seen this happen is in the phenomenon of online classified advertisements where things like newspapers are no longer needed. And you see it most explicitly in peer-to-peer file sharing networks where things like music publishers are no longer needed. Of course, much to the dismay of music publishers. To me, this ties in importantly to openness because disintermediation also means that the role of editors as content filters is minimized and eliminated. And a lot of people argue in favor of the role of an editor as the maintainer of the quality or the integrity of a system, but in a distributed environment, the quality or the integrity of the information is maintained by the network as a whole and rather than by some privileged members of the network. Disaggregation or unbundling, as it's sometimes called, and there was much discussion of the unbundling of education in the early days of online learning, and this is continuing to be the case. And it's this unbundling that was originally part of the concept of learning objects, where something like as large as a course was too unwieldy, too designed for a specific purpose in order to be shared. But the contents of a course, if broken down into more discrete modules or lessons, were the sorts of things that could be much more easily shared. Now, of course, in learning objects, they immediately took learning objects and came up with a technology to rebundle them in content packages, which kind of, in my mind, defeated the purpose. But we see this in things like blogging networks, RSS networks, where you don't access an entire blog, an entire website, but you access it one post at a time, and it sees one post that are shared through the network. That's an excellent idea. Even I was beginning to find myself stuffy. This is more of a technical point or an architectural point. But I think it's an important concept. I call it disintegration. If you think about it, there's two ways to design, if you will, software. And one way is to design everything as an aspect of a single system. And another way is to design it as separate, freestanding applications that communicate with each other. Now, in my own mind, there's again a bit of fuzziness here, but I think of Windows as an example of this one integrated system, and Windows illustrates the danger or the weakness of that sort of approach, because any application that runs on Windows is to a certain degree embedded in the whole Windows environment. So, the advantage, of course, is, you know, things like copy and paste work between applications and all of that. But it also means that a bug or a virus or whatever in one application can infect the operating system as a whole. And it means that if one part of it crashes, that it can, although it doesn't always these days, happily it used to always, take down the entire system. But the other way, having separate applications, particularly in a distributed environment, allows for a degree of separation and therefore greater robustness. If each application is standalone, the fact that one of them goes down doesn't mean that the rest of them go down. If you imagine the World Wide Web, right? If for some reason Flickr goes down, your access to the web isn't thereby disabled. You can still use everything else. It just means that Flickr is down for a little bit. So it means that parts can come and parts can go. Another aspect here that I want to draw out too, is that in these integrated systems, they very often come with a system-specific or proprietary system of internal communications. None of us, for example, or at least, well, probably none of us, can really, how do I want to phrase this? I don't want to say that. I wanted to say a certain thing, but it just wasn't there. In the distributed system, however, the disintegrated system, the mechanisms for communication between the different applications are open. They're understood. Any of us could create one of them. Any of us could create an application that stands alone and communicates with the rest of the network. And this is the strength of something like RSS, is that it is one of these open communications formats. So Flickr, again, which is standalone, issues RSS feeds. I can build an application that reads these feeds. This is the autonomy, diversity, and the impossibility of control. And I've put all of those under the heading of democratization. I don't know. I don't know what the best way of characterizing that is. We're almost done the principles. Dynamics, the fluidity aspect of it. And I want to draw this out too. The principle is desegregation. The idea here is that instead of creating applications for specific domains, such as for education, that we think of our applications as being each part of a larger system. In slogan form, I say that as something like ending the separation between learning and life, or that learning and life become one and the same sort of thing. In more pragmatic terms, it means that the tools that we're looking at for education ought to be thought of as tools that we would use more generally, rather than education-specific instances of tools. Nobody would have thought it made sense to create an education-specific version of email that you could only use in the university. Well, except maybe for that person there. Is that out of memory? Or is it just an editorial comment on the part of the camera? So we think. I was in Bratislava, of course, and one of the t-shirts, one said Bratislava, the other one said, still watching you, KGB, and I couldn't resist it. They're in that camera. Well, I sort of wondered after all those Slovakian police. I'm pausing while you do that, or should I?
Just go on.
Just go on? Alright. Are you kidding? If I did, I would do nothing all day if I didn't let myself be disturbed by technology. Nobody would think of an education-specific web browser. That wouldn't make sense. And so, similarly, it doesn't make sense to think of education-specific technology in a wider sense. Who was it wrote recently that, I think it was either Alan Levine or Brian Lamb or someone, they could use Drupal as a perfectly good learning management system. And it's true. The reason why we got learning management systems is because when these were being developed, we didn't really have yet good content management systems. Now you can get really good content management systems for free, and people are still paying for WebCT and Blackboard. And we need to keep that in mind as we look at the next generation of web technologies. All right, hand waving for stuff. Tools that people use to create things. MySpace, blogs and wikis. Podcasting, vodcasting, Flickr for photos. I'm zipping through these because I assume you all know about them. Is that right? No, it's, yeah, okay, good. Where we're going in learning technology, based on pretty much everything I've said so far, is what's leading to this, is a shift from the learning management system to what, under some headings, is being called the personal learning environment. Now, when I was in Manchester, we were talking about the name personal learning environment. We didn't really want to say it's personal learning environment because it's one of the things I said and other people were saying. It's more of an approach than a piece of technology. And then because of that last thing, we don't want education-specific things. We don't want to say that they're personal learning environments because, you know, they're not going to be specifically for learning. But we didn't want to change it from PLEs to P's because that didn't make sense. So we weren't really sure what to call them. So for now, we'll continue to use the terminology personal learning environment with the understanding that that's not really what we mean. The main point of the personal learning environment is to situate learning in the domain of the individual learner with the idea that this learner is in one of these networks as described. These networks of resources, these networks of connections. This is the classic diagram. Let's see if this pops up. This thing didn't pop up the last time I tried, but why is this slow? La-di-da-di-da-di-da. This is just a bad image to try to blow up. Oh, it's smaller. I don't know why it popped up in this. There we go. That's better. This is the picture. Let me ask first of all, how many of you have seen it? Oh, not that many. Two, three, less than half, maybe a quarter. All right. VLE stands for Virtual Learning Environment, and that was written before Personal Learning Environment as a term was coined. I wonder who coined that. Oh, it doesn't matter. Wasn't me. Anyhow, this is the Personal Learning Environment, and the idea is that you have your web presence, your application, if you will, and instead of everything being in the one place, all of your resources, your connections, etc., are distributed across the internet. So, for example, we have Flickr, which is the place where we might store our images. We have 43 things, which might be a to-do list type of thing. We have LiveJournal for blogs and blog postings. We have LearnDirect for learning resources. Personal hosting for personal information type stuff, or an e-portfolio. Alert or whatever. You see what I mean? Now, these are all hosted in different places. They're not hosted at the institution. The institution, the university, if you will, becomes just one of many service providers, and possibly not even the most important service provider. The other important aspect, and it doesn't really come through in this diagram, is that it is the choice of the person running this PLE which of these resources that they use. Suppose, for example, blog posts become part of some sort of learning that they're taking, that they're doing with some institution. The person can choose to use LiveJournal, or they can choose to use Blogger, or they can choose to use TypePad, or they can host their own WordPress system somewhere, like on their own internet service, or whatever. It's up to them how they choose to do this. Well, we're going to go back to that again, aren't we? My own approach to all of this is very similar. What this here is, is an application called MyGlue. What this application does is it joins RSS feeds from different sites. So if you saw from the previous diagram, things like Flickr and Delicious and that, it joins my feed from Delicious, my feed from Flickr, and my feed from my own website. And then I've taken this. Now, those of you who are programmers here, I am not a programmer. So this is not good code. This code has only the virtue of it works. Sort of. Barely. Anyhow. So here's the MyGlue, right, as one of the content sources. The idea is that a person using an environment like this can select from any number of different content sources, including their own content. In the full final finished version of an application like this, they could also access pages from Wikipedia, predefined searches from Google, any sort of resource. In my system, I define this list of resources in an OPML file so that this application simply reads that OPML file and gives me a selection. So I select, and now what's happening is this thing went to these external applications, brought the content in. The content was presented in RSS feeds. This is these separate applications talking to each other now, right? So it brought these contents, and oh, I see the errors in red now. Well, it wasn't in red this morning, and I haven't changed. Like I said, so here's some content, and the idea here is that I can take this content and put it into an editing window, and I can give it a title, or I can add my own text, and even be creative with it by making it bold. Okay, that's just a dumb old text editor, right? This could be any sort of content manipulation, content creation application. But the idea here is that I can access content from multiple sources and put them all in the same environment. So this is a place where I bring things together, repurpose, remix, reshape them, right? So it's not just reading, but it's also a creating environment. And then the third thing, and very importantly, is I can upload this to any one of these services. Now, in this particular one, I can only upload to Blogger. So, never. Oh, right. I've been there before. Cover your eyes. You didn't see that. All right. So now the content has been uploaded to Blogger. And now any of you can... never mind. Thank you. And there it is. This is an actual blogger post. Now, oops, I didn't mean to do that. I was going to take his follower. Yeah, okay. And here's the image on Flickr. And you see how these separate applications are interacting. I've done talks in a couple of places. In fact, the first time I did it was in UConn, hence the name of this blog. Where, you know, and this is one of these discussions, you know, a couple hundred people, so you're not really going to have a whole lot of chatter, but you still want to involve them. And I go to the talk, and near the beginning of the talk, I pull out my digital camera, take a photograph of the audience. And then as I'm talking, you know, tying networks, wave hand, wave hand, wave hand, I take the card out of my camera, and I upload the photograph onto my computer. And then I go to Flickr and upload the photograph onto Flickr. And you know, I'm just talking about something else. I'm just doing this. And then I get to this point, and I show this RSS writer. And the blog post on UConn Mania is actually the photograph that I took of the audience. And this is Anchorage in Alaska. And so this post I produced while I was giving that talk, and it's a very powerful message, because the message is, as I'm standing here giving a talk to you, I have created a learning resource. Well, not a very good one, but you know, give me some slack, I'm giving a talk. You know. But this completely changes the dynamics, doesn't it? And if you're still in this environment where you're thinking of learning as static resources that are to be stored in a content management system and managed in a learning management system, this picture of learning is very different. This picture of learning is all of those network things that I was talking in the earlier part of the talk, which really seem like wild hand-waving, I'm being real fuzzy, kind of theoretic, you know. But now you get into this kind of thing where this is the sort of thing that you're doing every day, and it's a completely different picture from the picture of, you know, learning as, you know, well, I'm going to study some texts now and look at some photographs and fill in a multiple choice quiz. It's just a different model. How am I doing on time and place?
Almost four.
Okay.
But I mean, no one's going to kick us out of the room somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. What I've just depicted is what I have characterized as e-learning 2.0. And to quote from myself, patting myself on the back there, it's the model of e-learning as being a type of content produced by publishers, organized and structured into courses, and consumed by students, in other words, the model that everyone uses, is turned on its head. Insofar as there is content, it is used rather than read, right? And is, in any case, and this is very important, more likely to be produced by students than by courseware authors. And if you think, how absurd, I refer you to Wikipedia, which is produced by non-experts. And insofar as there's a structure, it's more likely to resemble a language or a conversation rather than a book or a manual. And again, I come back to, think of these blog posts as though they were a word in a conversation, rather than like a book or a paragraph or text or something static. Think of it as this communication flow. And think of the dynamics and the way of perceiving a blog post from the point of view of, you know, it's part of this. For those of you listening online, I'm waving my hands. It's part of this circulation, this environment, this thing that you're immersing yourself into, rather than this information that is being communicated or transmitted to you. I sometimes characterize what I'm proposing as a departure from traditional distance learning theory, in the sense that distance learning theory is traditionally a theory of, well, it's a communications theory-based approach. It's an approach based on the transmission of information from one entity to another entity. And what I'm saying is that this doesn't happen. It's rather one thing presents something and it's perceived by something else, but something new, completely new, is created in the receiver than was sent from the sender. And each receiver creates something slightly different. And I know this is not a new theory necessarily, but from the perspective of distance learning, it's different from the theory that is currently being used by most designers. Personal learning environments. Terry Anderson wrote, not a long document, but a useful document on some of the advantages. He also listed the disadvantages, but I ignored those, of personal learning environments. One that I consider really important is persistence. This has certainly been a factor in my own life. When a person goes online in an institutional environment, like a WebCT course, and they participate in the community, and they put in all of their contents and all of that, and then the course ends and all of their content disappears in a puff of smoke. And what we know about online community is that online community has to have persistence. It has to have a life that extends beyond the end of a course. It has to have, as some of the commentators have said, a sense of history, a sense of shared culture that persists over time. When the community is institution-based, that isn't the case. The communities come, communities go, almost arbitrarily. Another advantage, and this is something that we talked a lot about just this morning, is identity. With the personal learning environment, identity becomes the property of the learner. A learner is more in control of his or her own identity. And I mean this in two senses. I mean this in one sense, in the sense that I was talking about at the beginning of this course, but also in a very more practical, pragmatic sense, in that a person can have a single identity across different institutions, across different services. If you think about your own experience with the World Wide Web right now, you have one identity on Yahoo and a very different, completely unconnected identity on Microsoft Network. And if you log into a university service, a third identity, and so on, right? You might have four or five. I have like dozens of identities because every time I go to one of these centralized services, I have to log in and create a new user account and all of that. But if my access to these resources is based on my use of a personal learning environment, then all of these identities are associated with each other. I can create and maintain a single identity. And indeed, we are going to build something like that identity into one of these services. This is an approach that I developed called MIDM, which I pronounced My D Me, and which somebody else suggested sounds like Mighty Me, which I thought, gee, I should trademark that, but I forgot. And it is, if you follow this link, you'll find a bunch of papers on self-identification. But the principle here is that you are the one who asserts your identity. Rather than your university asserting your identity or Microsoft asserting your identity. And the way you assert your identity is you establish an online presence, either yourself or through some broker, and you associate yourself with that online presence. This diagram here depicts the manner in which that online presence interacts with remote web services. And basically, the way it works is you put your identity into the header of your web browser. Your web browser declares itself to any site that you go to, and the site has an interaction with your web server that confirms, yes, I am the person that I claim to be. And you might think, Now, in the context of the web, this is a very radical position. In the context of the web, you don't pre-identify yourself like that. But outside the web, we have many cases where your application actually serves as its own identification mechanism. I've listed a few there. Your car identifies itself. It has a license plate on it. And anywhere your car goes, it's saying, here I am. I am QMXLP, whatever, whatever. I don't know. I don't have a car, so I don't know what license plates look like. And I don't know what they look like here, although I've seen probably millions of them. Funny how they just don't register. Your telephone, right? When you go to use your telephone, you don't type in your own telephone number first. In fact, you would think that's really ridiculous. Your telephone identifies itself. Similarly, if you use an ATM, you don't type in your bank account number. That's contained in the card that you present to the machine. In a similar way, and I'm quite certain something like this will be the case, your browser or some similar application, when you go to use it, will identify itself. I'm thinking the MyVMe approach presumes a plugin of some sort or an extension to your web browser. What's important here is this is a distributed system of identification. There are other proposals out there, but they're centralized systems. There's the Shibboleth, which is the federated system, and there are some registry-based systems such as SCIP or LID. But none of, and of course there was the old Microsoft Passport system in which you surrender your identity to Microsoft and it manages it for you. And none of these have taken off. And the reason why none of these have taken off is because, I think, of ownership. People want to own their own identity, just in the same way they want to own their own content, and for the same reason, because owning their own identity is a way of establishing their own identity. In this case, it's almost tautological. Other advantage of personal learning environments is just in the management of the content produced by a person. And we mentioned this issue briefly earlier on, where when a person contributes content to a university system, questions of ownership become, shall we say, fuzzy. Certainly questions of management and control become fuzzy. And that's why the case of UBC, where the students wanted to have their system external to the university site. Using a PLE allows you to upload content to sites where you're confident that it is your content, and you're confident that the university cannot arbitrarily say delete this content. And this is one of the things, again, like when you're in one of these online courses, you upload content, and for some reason, who knows why, computer services didn't like it, whatever, your content goes poof and it's gone. That can't happen is less likely to happen, I should say, if you're working in a distributed environment. And actually, because I'm paranoid about that sort of thing, what I do is I actually put my content in several places, so that even if it disappears in one place, it's still in another place. I'm just like that. Over time, there will be much closer management of this content. Closer management, but non-intrusively. And I know that sounds a bit like a contradiction, but again, you saw the RSS writer that I demonstrated there. Now, one of the things I haven't put into that RSS writer is something that looks like this, but you can see how it would be fairly straightforward to add something like this into it. This is actually something that was developed for the EduSource project, and as a result, it wasn't released properly. But the idea here is when you create some content, you can, at the same time, determine the conditions under which that content is being released. And in this example, free giveaway, demo 10 views, $10 special, full reuse. The idea here is that when you create content, you can associate it with a distribution model, or as I sometimes call it, a DRM model. on this system, the DRM models were created in ODRL, Open Digital Rights Language. And the idea is that in the metadata describing the content, there is a pointer to the relevant ODRL model. And when you pick from one of these, that's selecting the pointer that will be embedded in the metadata. Now, if you're thinking that sounds awkward and confused, it isn't really. It's pretty much exactly the same mechanism that is used by Creative Commons. In Creative Commons, when you choose to use a Creative Commons license, for example, attribution, share alike, non-commercial, you pick the Creative Commons logo that you're going to put on your web page. And what that Creative Commons logo does is it points to a page on the Creative Commons website. This is the same thing, except instead of pointing to a page on the Creative Commons website, it points to a page anywhere on the internet where you have put an ODRL file. And the ODRL file allows you to express a much wider range of licensing conditions. It includes all of the Creative Commons conditions, but if you wanted commercial licensing as well, that can also be expressed in ODRL. Now, you might ask, why is this important? And the reason why it's important is this whole aggregation, remix, reuse kind of thing. The idea here is that we're putting commercial and non-commercial content into the same space, which means that the mechanisms that we use to license it, the mechanisms that we use to distribute it, the mechanisms that we use to create it even, are the same in all cases. That allows us to have a space where we do have some commercial content and we have private content, where the student just creating a learning resource on their own has, from the point of view of the network, the same standing as a commercial publisher. And indeed, the commercial publisher can offer free stuff and the student can offer stuff for sale. It all depends on whether they think they can actually generate revenue from it. The main thing and the main purpose of this approach is to offer an alternative to approaches characterized by the elimination of free content from the mix. If you look at, for example, the music distribution services that are there, like iTunes or whatever, all of the content comes from major publishers, and none of it's available for free. You always have to pay, right? There are no free songs on iTunes. Even if a musician wanted to offer their free songs, it's not there, right? It's a closed market space. And the idea here is to create an open market where commercial and non-commercial offerings have the same standing and can be selected. There's a lot more to the DDRM model than is here. This is, you know, the top of the iceberg. Now, I just want to talk very briefly about what the GLE is, because I want to make it clear that I'm not talking about some kind of application that somebody is building. Now, there is an application that somebody is building. CETUS in Manchester is building a PLE. But what's more important to me is that the descriptions here characterize an approach rather than some proprietary application. And indeed, out there in the PLE world, there's already this tension between the question of whether a PLE is going to be offered by some institution and become part of an institutional range of software offerings, or whether it'll be something that is separate from and distinct from any given institution. Based on what I've said so far, you can probably guess that I fall into the second camp, that I don't see the PLE as being something that should be offered by an institution, but rather something that a person can choose. They can choose from a range of different types of PLEs. It's like choosing a web browser or choosing an email service, although, of course, institutions try to control those as well, so maybe that's not a good example. It's an approach. not an application. Think of it more like email except for the web rather than some specific tool like Outlook. You know, think of it that way. I don't know. I'm thinking about the time right now. I do have a section 5, but I don't know if I want to do section 5.
You didn't have one of those small numbers here. You know, some people do where they say, which is things like 30 out of 100.
Oh, no, because I always do that, you see. And so, and sometimes I really, like, kind of fake it, right? I hit the last slide, and then I say, and that's it for my talk, and I don't tell the audience that there's another 10 or 20 slides that I just decided to skip, but in this case I'm being more honest. Look, there's, you know, and we talked a bit about this morning, there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that a PLE should do. I've talked about the PLE should also be an application that allows you to rate resources. It should be an application that supports social networking, that supports communication, instant messaging, audio conferencing. It should tie into the Skype API, for example, and things like that. You know, it should allow you to track your usage and make this usage tracking available as metadata that can be harvested by third parties, either under certain usage conditions or as a condition of use. For example, if you're accessing a university resource, using your PLE, you should be able to choose between different identities. So, you know, I'm Stephen Downs at home, and I'm using my PLE to look up dart sites and locations of pubs. And then Stephen Downs at work, where I'm using my PLE to look up, well, dart sites. Oh, yeah. They said the word pub, and the camera complains.
I just wanted to make a suggestion here.
Yeah.
How about a real break? I mean, a real coffee break, going outside and a bit of fresh air and stuff, and leave it to interested parties, if you are still up to it, and have a short, more conversational session on the PLE site, on what you just started to talk about, some of those characteristics.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Give it up to people who would want to stay with us, and I'm not sure if you're still up for that.
Yeah, I don't want to go, like, too long, but I'm certainly. I just want to. Just so I just want. Yeah. Let me just show you what you're missing.
Go ahead.
I can't resist. It's because I never get through all my slides. It's frustrating. Actually, it's not.
I'm not saying that we would cut them out. I mean, this
is for the people on the web, right? Because like the people on the web, they get my whole slideshow, and then they listen to the audio, and they think, well, it doesn't match. It does match. It's just I dropped some slides. You want to. If any of this appeals to you, I've written about the semantic social network, and this is more of this XML background, because I want you to picture this in your mind, right? That, you know, on the web so far, we've dealt with links between content, which we call, of course, links, right? But there's this rich underlying layer of linkages that we can define. The social networking sites like Orkut and Friendster and that have captured a little bit, but in a really awkward and non-real way. It's like Joy Ito has like 10,000 friends. Like, who has 10,000 friends? And you know what really bothers me? I'm not one of them. Like, anybody on the web can be Joy Ito's friend, but I'm not one of them. But but there are ways we can think of social networks. I personally think of a social network can be derived from, you know, what is your social network? Well, those are the people you actually do communicate with, those whose websites you actually do read, you know, so that sort of thing. But the point is, when you combine things like social networking and semantic networking, you can get, you know, feeds, automatic feeds, such as resources on learning objects read by people who are David Wiley or friends of David Wiley. You know, and it produces a very sharply focused set of resources. And the connections, the web of connections is sufficiently dense, sufficiently mesh-like as opposed to star-like, that the network organizes itself. Now, everybody talks about this stuff in terms of search and discoverability, but once the network is sufficiently dense, then instead of you having to find resources, resources can present themselves to you. Again, think of it as flow rather than static. Search presupposes static. Search is a library metaphor, right? But in a dynamic, flowing environment, search is useless, right? Because search is always focused to the past.
Just to remark that Hans Zilskrip, who's going to be around on Wednesday for this pre-conference workshop, he keeps saying when he reflects on this that he very much meets people now, or follows people.
Mm-hmm.
So they become his filters, and they become the main mechanism for pre-selection.
Sure.
So he sort of reviews his own information space,
yeah.
And he said he just dropped a lot of journal subscriptions, a lot of these, you know, non-personal.
Who is that said that?
Tom Zilstra, this guy from the Netherlands.
Okay. I've done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I see that, you know, why would I choose like a commercial publishing entity as my filtering mechanism? It makes no sense, right? You know, because they don't have this kind of focus that, you know, now of course there's sort of, you know, then again, it's not completely true. But anyhow, the main point here, though, is that these things present themselves to you rather than you going to get them. Now, and to take this one step further, go back to the RSS writer that I demonstrated. Imagine that you're typing something into it, and that just like his phone, your writer offers up things that are relevant to what you're writing based on your network of friends and your demonstrated interest. So I'm writing a paper, say, on learning objects, and I'm typing away learning objects, learning blah, 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 blah. On the side, instead of me selecting from stuff, I just get resources that either I've read, rated highly, my friends have read, whatever, and these resources are presented from this dynamic stream, which means they're resources that have been written in the last few days. So, you know, using normal search, I probably wouldn't find them, but I have state-of-the-art access to the current discussion on the thing that I'm typing right now from the members of the community of which I'm a part. Picture it. Now, would this work? Probably. Would it be useful? That's an empirical question. But I think it would be incredibly useful. Now here's the part you're going to miss. Semantics. Nobody wants semantics. Everybody hates semantics anyways. Except me. I love semantics. I can talk about semantics for the rest of the day. How meaning is created in networks. Network semantics. This is all this point of view stuff, right? Your perspective, how you see something, what gives something meaning. You know, you think about how each of you are watching this talk, and you know, and some of you are watching it and listening to it from the perspective of certain projects. I've forgotten the name of it, that's why I can't name it.
I can't,
right? You're seeing it like some things that I say are more relevant to you, more salient. Because of the projects that you're working on. All of that, the network allows us, meaning emerges from the network. See, aren't you missing great stuff here? And then my take on George's theory, which I don't think George likes. I think of connectivism as network pragmatics, how context impacts our way of viewing emergent content or emergent meaning from the network. See, emergentism is well known, right? It's a pattern of connectivity. You perceive the pattern, but the way what you perceive in the pattern depends on your point of view, depends on what you're up to. Blah blah blah. Principles of connectivism. Sorry, George. And that's my talk.
At least you mentioned our project now, which was
Pardon?
At least you mentioned the iCamp, our project.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So for those of you who were actually able to listen to this online audio presentation for 2 hours, at the end of that 2 hour period, you heard a one word reference to their project, which is called iCamp. Okay, that was a pretty informal talk. I really hope you got some value out of it, and again, these slides may possibly be on my website, depends on my internet access later on this evening. If not, they will certainly be on my website after I get back to Canada later this week.
Oh, just keep you in the building until they
are. Yeah. Well, you can't keep me in the building, but you can keep me in Vienna. It wouldn't be that hard. Of course, it would cost you thousands of dollars. But it wouldn't be hard. Yeah. And you'd have to explain flying my wife and my cats from Canada. Yes, and then there's the Ferrari. Oh, okay, that's not on, no.
University of Economic Takeover.
Yeah, yeah. We're still rolling. Any comments or questions or anything like that before we wrap up?
Oh, just a quick question, comment. I think that maybe half a bit more of the characteristics that you described were like decentralized disintermediation, etc. You know, we're already present, or at least very much, clearly kind of prefigured in the original, in the internet, you know, as it was in the same internet.
Sure.
So then my question is, what happened?
Yeah.
And then the next question is, like, what's to prevent it from happening again? Like, in other words, what's the relationship between your ideas and the developments of technology? And does having these things there really end up changing what happens in the way people behave?
I don't know if we can have any more of these tirades. No, you're absolutely right. Now, it's no coincidence that these things were in the internet because, I mean, you know, at heart, I'm an empiricist. And I can see as well as the next person when something works as compared to when something doesn't. And we've got the most spectacular example of something working, you know, especially as far as communications is concerned, in human history. Nothing has ever come close to the success of the web. Not even remotely, right? So you got to draw some lessons from that. And that's what I very explicitly do in my own thinking, right? The web works. And interestingly, the web worked against every effort to make it not work. Remember the, you know, I remember, you know, the early 90s. It was still an open question whether people would use the internet or whether people would use CompuServe. Right, and you remember how long it took before America Online actually opened itself to the internet? I mean, this was not a done deal. America Online, all the way up until the mid to late 90s, thought that it would be able to survive based on proprietary content, and it eventually opened itself up to the internet because it was either do that or die, right? And the internet was so appealing that the closed commercial alternative had no chance. Now, we've been running through this scenario again and again. This is not an isolated thing. You know, look at things. Well, look at the Apache Webster.
By the way, I'm not expecting you to answer my question, really. But
well, no, this is a serious answer, and it came up in our discussions downstairs too, and that's why I want this to come out actually. The sort of model that I talk about, one that promotes diversity, one that promotes openness, I forget the other conditions, but you know what I mean. You know, the sort of thing with open content, free content, open source alternatives, free exchange, all of those sorts of things. That kind of network is so attractive that once the network is established, the commercial operators have two choices: adapt to it or die. Look at publishing, journal publishing, right? We're getting things like the Open Archives and Open Archives Initiative. We're getting things like the Public Library of Science, and we're getting things now like legislation saying that in order to qualify for government funding, you have to make your article available, openly, without charge. And this form of academic publishing, where people are able to read your articles for free, is so attractive compared to paying for academic journal subscriptions that the academic journals must adapt to this.
Well, Napster is really attractive.
That story isn't over.
Okay. Yeah.
That story is far from over. I mean, look where the music publishers wanted to go, and compared to where they are now, even, right? Like iTunes, they would have freaked. There are music services that offer unencumbered MP3s. And don't forget, there's still the very legal Russian service, All of MP3, which is selling these commercial songs for like 2 cents, or 5 cents, or whatever it is in rubles. I don't know. And of course, it's a trade issue. It's a WTO issue, the existence of All of MP3. But also, don't forget, in the world of music, right now, there's a thing called the PodSafe Music Network. And the PodSafe Music Network is providing audio content that people can reproduce in their own podcasts. And I project that at some point, the top 10 music is going to come from this free content rather than the commercial content. And it's simply a matter of numbers, right? Free content gets more exposure. So once that starts happening, once commercial music becomes less popular than free music, the model has to shift. Because selling music, particularly selling music in a restricted DRM encumbered format, isn't on anymore. Right? Look at classified advertisements. The way you used to do classified advertisements is you would phone or visit a newspaper, you would pay them money, they would run your advertisement. Now, you just log on to Craigslist in North America, type in your ad, pay nothing, and, well, that's it. Well, free classified ads versus pay classified ads. Newspapers are finding they no longer have classified ad sections. And newspapers are folding. Entire newspaper chains are folding. Look at what happened to Knight Ritter. So that's just it. The distributed, the open, the free, once it gets established, is always more attractive than the commercial.
So do you also predict a culture clash going on, or we see a culture clash in a formal higher educational environment?
Oh, absolutely. Look at the whole discussion of informal learning, right? Look at the stuff that Jay Cross is doing and all of that. Arguably, and I would argue, informal learning is certainly in the corporate environment much more prevalent than formal learning, and becoming more so in the non-corporate environment, and becoming more so in the personal environment. Think about those of you who know how to program a computer. Think about how much you learned in a classroom as compared to how much you learned on your own, right? So what happens at the tipping point when the institution no longer controls the certification. It's going to happen. It has to happen, right? If you can demonstrate that you can program competently in Java, you don't need a degree in computer science. You just go in there, show you can do it.
The movement is totally contrary to that. Actually, most people currently don't have a degree in computer science or work in computer science,
mm-hmm.
and we're currently trying to install institutions that enable those people to get a certification or whatever.
Based on what they already know, right? So you see what's happening. The learning is separating from the certification, right? They learn on their own and then get certified, rather than they learn and get certified in the same place, right? Right now, for most disciplines, the learning and the certification happen in the same place, the university or the college, right? But if you could learn anywhere and then get certified, what happens to all the economics of a university? If I could get a BA without spending 4 years at an institution and spending $40,000 and giving up my earnings and employment for those 4 years, what happens to an institution that depends on me going to it for 4 years for its financial viability? You know, it's going to create a crisis. And it's one of these crises, it'll be like 15, 20 years in the making, but it'll be overnight. It'll be all of a sudden, the university system is in crisis. Because, you know, the U.S. government or something like that suddenly said, a degree from a testing agency has the same validity as the degree from a four-year institution.
But who's going to, the thing is that you have to think about the power politics that's sort of things here. Like, just because it's efficient doesn't mean it's going to happen.
I agree. The reason why it's going to happen is because people want it.
Right now, already ECL certificate institutes are making a tremendous amount of money in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Which certification? That kind of thing works in certain fields.
Hey, but what prevents it from working in philosophy?
It works for other disciplines as well. For example, there's a long tradition in German jurisprudence, yes, of having paid tutors. So whenever somebody approaches the final exams, he's usually going for 2 years or at least 2-3 semesters of paying somebody to get trained. Paying somebody not being part of the university, actually it's usually students or people that are finished on tutoring. And so that's one of the issues in the computer science field, so there's a whole bunch of subjects or areas where this is happening.
In Canada, at the college level, there's a large, what they call PLAR, Prior Learning Assessment and Review, a large movement there. And if you do a Google search under PLAR, you'll find a lot of materials related to that. It's so obvious it's coming. It's like, you remember the photos of the tsunami, right? And you look at the photo and you see the tsunami. The tsunami is there. And I know there's still people playing on the beach, but... This is an insane photo, right? But it's so obvious it's coming. Right? Like, as soon as you, it's one of these things, as soon as you start to look for it, you see it everywhere, right? And it's there. And so, eventually, people will be able to, build their own custom degrees based on their own learning and mechanisms of assessment. I mean, because if you think about it, degrees are really bundled recognitions of certification, aren't they? And unbundling is the way of the future. So, instead of having a BA, you'd have, a whole set of qualifications. You match that set of qualifications to employment requirements or whatever. And where you present those on your MyVME site as part of, an XML file. And, when you do an employment application, basically you just push a button, blink, and that's your employment application, because why would you type this in twice? Or if you really wanted to customize, you just sort of check the things that you want your prospective future employer to see. This business of tying sitting in a chair for 4 years in order to have an academic credential on analysis will be found to be, it's not simply that it's inefficient, it's that people have better ways to spend 4 years. And even today, even now, the argument in defense of the traditional four-year institution is not pedagogically based. It's not academically based. It's socially based. People develop networks of friends. People do their best learning at the university pub. People gain lots of experience from university clubs and things like that. At least that's the debate in North America. I would bet it's the same here. And so you see more and more of the social aspects of the university or the formal educational system being stressed over the academic. And as that becomes more prevalent, it becomes harder and harder for politicians to justify financing this. Now, how long before somebody says, look, we're spending $180 million a year financing a social club for rich people? You know, can you just imagine the effectiveness of an argument like that in the middle of an election, right? And when you put it that way, you know, financing social clubs for rich people, all of a sudden, you know, university funding overnight, again, becomes in a crisis. So, and also, particularly when this socialization, this embedding in a community of practice, all of these things that I just talked about in this presentation become possible and widely understood to be possible in the online world. And not just in the online world, but, you know, I mean, we know how it works now, right? We develop these networks of connections virtually online, and then we do have these personal connections, right? We have Norm and me sitting within 5 feet of each other, and Seb on the other side of the room, and all of you guys here. The personal is still there. It's not eliminated. It's, in fact, enhanced informally in a rough, loose, messy, non-academic kind of way. This kind of learning, so important, yet so not recognized. And this is what's going to replace the university system, and it will replace the university system the second we come up with an alternative form of credentialing. Less than a second.
Well, thanks a lot. I think looking at the time now, maybe we do have a small break and do some more socializing.
Sure.
Kind of so,
and I'll turn off the microphone so we can feel free to lie freely.
Is that your license for lying?
Actually, here's how this works. At any given time, I could be wired for sounds. Nah, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't do that to people. But I try to conduct myself as though somebody's recording it. Thanks a lot. And all of you, I really appreciate you taking a beautiful afternoon and sitting here in this room. It's, you know, a really nice welcome, and I appreciate it very much. So, and do feel free to write me or questions or whatever. That's my web address, and I'm always happy to communicate and interact with people online. So, thanks a lot.
By the way, is it online as well?
Yes.
Your cat?
Now dead, sadly.
Oh.
But still online. My cat will be online as long as I have a website.